Our first case for argument is Zapata Hermanos versus Hearthside. Mr. Cole.
Judge Posner, may it please the court. The court below awarded $500,000, or slightly in excess of that, in attorney's fees against Maurice Linnell for literally every aspect of the case from the beginning to the end. And it did it despite the fact that half of the case was devoted to the defense, to the jury instruction conference, to the jury instructions, and to the closing arguments. And there was no dispute that, at least as to that half of the case, it was a perfectly legitimate enterprise that Linnell was engaging in. The court also did that despite the fact that at least approximately $80,000 of the plaintiff's claim was a perfectly legitimate endeavor, and there was no allocation based upon that. And it did it despite the fact that the court found that even had there been payment, the case would have proceeded in any event. There was no attempt made to monetize the report and make it proportional to or causally connected to the alleged misconduct engaged in by the defendant.
I was actually puzzled that there was a trial, because Judge Shader seemed to think that you clearly owed, you know, at least, what, $850,000?
That's exactly right.
So why didn't he just enter, or maybe he did, I'm just confused about the background, but why wouldn't he just enter summary judgment for that?
Zapata tried to have summary judgment entered, Your Honor, and they did it on the basis, and this is a critical fact as we've set forth in the briefs, they did it on the basis of responses that had been made 3 months in discovery, 3 months after the answer had been filed. Judge Shader concluded that there was a component, namely some $80,000, that was still at issue legitimately.
Sure, but have a trial on the component.
Why
have a trial on the whole
thing? Didn't Judge Shader really make a legal error here? I'm looking at page 26 of the appendix to your brief, which is where you've reproduced Judge Shader's memorandum opinion in order of July 7, 2000.
Yes.
And in that order, he says that he was compelled to deny this motion for summary judgment you're talking about, not because of any flaws, but rather because of what can or cannot qualify as a partial summary judgment. And at that point, he equates partial summary judgment with the kind of judgment that could be made subject to a 54B order. That's, of course, not right. Rule 56C specifically says that there can be partial summary judgment on liability. So it's
Judge Wood, if you're right, then clearly, yes, by definition.
No, I'm not right by definition, but I believe
No, I don't mean by, I mean if you are right, comma, then by definition the court's award of $550,000 fees for a needless trial is patently wrong. He made the mistake, and if the trial is a consequence then of what he did, not of what Zapata and its counsel, who he had great disdain for, did, then the award in its totality has to be reversed. But leaving that aside, although that is obviously a critical issue, for purposes of our presentation, what the court did, he did on the basis, first of all, of the Convention on the International Sale of Goods. And he concluded that since legal fees are a foreseeable consequence of any breach, they therefore are compensable as a matter of substantive law under the convention. That clearly was wrong. The issue was not on the question of foreseeability, and certainly not in a but-for sense. The question is the meaning of the word losses in Article 74. And there is nothing to suggest in the silence of the convention.
Is this Article 74, is this limited to suits in the nature of collection?
It is limited to breach of contract suits, Your Honor.
I know breach of contract, but could it be the buyer complaining he didn't get the product, or is it just
a suit for money? It's a suit by either party to the contract contending that there has been a breach by the opposite side, but it's clearly limited to. Let me go on. The question for the court was simply, is this a foreseeable consequence? That's not the issue. The question is, what is the meaning of the word losses? The convention was the culmination of 50 years of negotiation, debate, and controversy among some 63 signatories. it is inconceivable, given the real world, and one looks at that, as you have said, Judge Posner, in In Re Handy Andy, in determining the meaning of statutory language, to conclude that these 63 signatories who had in place in their nations deeply ingrained notions of social policy of who pays legal fees. Most of them had, if not all of them, had a loser pays.
Is it not true that most of those countries put the rules regarding attorney's fees in their codes of procedure,
right.
Their civil procedure codes? Certainly Germany and France do, which are kind of the paradigm code countries.
Canada does as well.
So these are you aware of any, suppose there were an ordinary contract case in which the parties had taken the precaution of excluding the application of the Convention on International Sale of Goods, which the convention allows
yes.
to happen. So it was a case in which, say, a New York party and a French party were litigating, and the court decided that French law applies. And so the court in New York is deciding the case under French law.
So under the convention?
No. The convention has been excluded,
right.
And the court simply goes through the ordinary choice of law drill that you go through in New York, and it decides on that basis that French law should be the law of the contract. Are you aware of any cases like that, which I'm sure happen all the time in New York as well as other states, where the court has also followed the civil procedure code of France and awarded attorney's fees according to the French civil procedure code?
Well, the closest case, I suppose, to what you're asking, Judge Wood, is Judge Friendly's decision that is in our reply brief at page 10, Conti versus Slota Mercantile Desistata. Judge Friendly addressed the question of whether a federal court would award attorney's fees pursuant to the laws of another nation, which in fact governed the party's dispute. He concluded that federal courts would not do so because the award of attorney's fees is a matter of procedural and not substantive law. That's the closest case, Judge Wood, that I can come to. Now, it is, at least to me, as a matter of statutory construction, inconceivable that after 50 years of debate, that 63 signatories would have enacted or promulgated a convention having more than 100 sections that occupies 60 or 70 pages in the supplemental appendix of Zapata that meticulously go through point by point by point of the various substantive provisions and yet say nothing about attorney's fees if in fact they intended attorney's fees to be governed by Article 74. There is simply not a mention either in the text, in the legislative history, or in any submission that has been made to you and or that I'm aware of that mentions the word legal fees.
But what
about... it works both ways, though.
Well, I don't think that it does, Judge Evans.
There's nothing in here that excludes it.
Well, if one looks to the text, to the legislative history, and to the real-world situation against which the language is to be construed, there were in place throughout the world procedural provisions that dealt with attorney's fees in every one of the signatory countries. Therefore, the silence on the question of attorney's fees is absolutely consistent with the in-place extant provisions that already governed. There was no need to address the question of attorney's fees. There was no need to displace, and certainly not by silence.
Well, don't you really...
Since there's existing world order.
Silence is obviously one of those things that you need to decide whether there is silence, first of all, whether this mention of consequential damages in Article 74 was intended to sweep over into one of these quasi-procedural matters like attorney's fees. But the convention itself has a couple of provisions that makes it clear that it's not covering everything about contract law. I'm thinking particularly of Article 4 and Article 7 of the convention. And so it would seem to me that that's more helpful, actually, in terms of the question whether this was really supposed to be a sweeping and comprehensive treatment of all issues that could possibly come up in a contract case, which might include a fee shift, or if it's a more limited document.
Well, there are provisions that make it clear that there are, in fact, there's one provision that says if, in fact, something is not expressly settled by the code, by the substantive provisions of the code, and attorney's fee provisions are procedural throughout the world, then, of course, one looks to the private provisions
yeah,
of international law.
Yeah, that's Article
7, expressly settled.
Yes, they're not expressly settled. But that doesn't address...
So you would say, then, it seems to me, your argument would have to be there's nothing express about attorney's fees.
No, but what that is referring to are the express substantive provisions
right.
of the convention. There is nothing substantive about attorney's fee provisions. They are throughout the world procedural. And so when one looks at that, I think that you can't draw from that the sense that, well, because attorney's fees aren't mentioned, therefore they may well have been lumped together in the word losses, even though for nobody makes any mention of them.
Before you run out of time, maybe on rebuttal, though, my question for you is really, suppose we agreed with you about the convention. It does seem to me that the alternate ground that Judge Shader gave his inherent power reflected his feeling that, in fact, your client was needlessly drawing out this litigation, that there was an overwhelming majority of debt that was clearly due, and he relied on that. Don't we review that for abuse of discretion?
Well, you do. But if there's been a legal mistake, then, of course, by definition, it's an abuse of discretion. His position on attorneys on the inherent authority doctrine is simply indefensible. First
but
of all,
you didn't tell him he was wrong.
Well,
I don't mean you personally, your side, if you will.
Well, you know, I can't. But this isn't a waivable issue. Judge Shader has the burden, the responsibility, actually, of making determinations of whether or not there are interstices that need to be filled, whether there are gaps that need to be filled, and he has the responsibility of determining whether other rules are inadequate. He didn't do any of those things. But beyond that, half of the case was devoted to the defense side of the case, which was perfectly legitimate, and Judge Shader never said it wasn't. There was no attempt to monetize at all the alleged misconduct, which occupies, let us say, the first half of the case, from the back end of the case. I mean, that's simply indefensible on his part. He concluded two things. First, he concluded that the non-payment prior to litigation was a basis for his inherent fee award. That's flatly wrong as a matter of law, and thus, by definition, abuse of discretion. You don't get to say that pre-litigation conduct constitutes a violation of or constitutes misconduct treatable under the inherent authority doctrine when the doctrine itself relates to misconduct during the course of the trial. The second and the only other basis upon which he made that judgment was the alleged misconduct that he said occurred during the trial. Well, that was the conduct by the lawyers, not by Linnell itself. And again, he did not deal with the question of the second half of the trial. He did not monetize at all or make any attempt to monetize the misconduct that caused some degree of harm. Certainly not every facet of this case from beginning to end was compensable under the inherent authority doctrine. It simply wasn't. Now, there is no basis to say there was. Zapata hasn't really attempted to show there was. There's simply the kind of unadorned conclusion in their briefs that all of this was so intertwined. Well, it wasn't intertwined at all. It's easy to segregate the front half of the case from the back half. And when I say half, I mean literally that. If you look at the transcript sites, you will see that literally half of the case is taken up on the front end. A component of the front end was a dispute about $72,000 and some odd dollars. That was legitimate. Much of the evidence, if not all of the evidence, that came in on the front end of this case through Zapata would have come in anyway in order to prevail on the $72,000 situation. For example, the background of the case, the background of the parties, how the purchase orders worked, how the invoices worked, the question of interest, which was an absolutely legitimate question, and went to the jury. All that was part and parcel of what this case was about. So even had Judge Shader not made the mistake, Judge Wood, that you think that he made at the front end, this case would have been tried. It would have been tried essentially in the same way, and it is indefensible to say that Judge Shader had the right under the inherent authority doctrine to award every penny from start to finish when at least half of the case. And one more point, and I will be done. Judge Shader said that as a consequence of the thoughtlessness of the lawyers, and I don't mean to include the Zapata lawyers, although I think that he was talking about both, but clearly talking about the folks on our side who we thought were bumptious pettifoggers. had more thought been given to the case, what did he say? This case could have been done in 2.5 to 3 days. Let's assume he's right, and this is in the briefs. Stupidity, ineptitude, and thoughtlessness are not the basis for sanctions under any doctrine, let alone the inherent authority doctrine. So if the case got dilated by a factor of 100%, that's not compensable under the inherent authority doctrine. And he needed to calculate those things and to calculate them nicely, and he didn't do that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Rubenstein?
May it please the Court, my name is Javier Rubenstein, and I am here today on behalf of the appellee, Zapata Hermanos Sucesores, who urges this Court to affirm the judgment of the District Court in its entirety. The findings in this case reveal one of the more blatant examples of commercial bad faith that one could imagine.
Well, one of the things I find puzzling about this is if you think that a contract has been broken in deliberately, under you know modern law now, you can seek punitive damages or attorney's fees as a form of punishment. I don't understand why that was not the way you proceed, since fee shifting is not the way one deals with, as Mr. Cole said, I think correctly, with pre-litigation misconduct.
Let me try to address your question, Judge Posner, in a couple of ways. First of all, the underlying conduct that Judge Shader pointed to as an act of bad faith, which was not by itself the only reason that he used in order to justify the bad faith sanction, was not simply the non-payment of invoices. It was Linnell's explicit threat that because Zapata was going to not ship any more goods unless
sure,
it was prepared.
Fine. Look, you know, then you can see you have all sorts of remedies against that sort of thing. Now you're saying, you know, they use duress. You know, that's a tort. They're behaving in an extortionate fashion. That's tortious. There are plenty of ways of attacking directly bad faith behavior by a contract partner. But I that seems to me how you're supposed to proceed, not this business of you know, using a convention, using inherent authority because you don't like Rule 11. I don't get that.
Judge Posner, with respect to the convention, we never argued, nor do we contend now.
Well, before you get into the convention, again, I don't understand. Am I wrong? Are there not perfectly good common law remedies for bad faith behavior by a contract partner? Someone who, I mean, the way you describe is a form of extortion, duress, deliberate breach. I think all these things are actionable.
So our understanding, Judge Posner, had been that a deliberate breach of contract was not itself a tort.
Well, and you see, that raises a similar problem that I have with the things Judge Posner's talking about. It's not like they said, if you don't continue to ship us cookie tins, we're going to come blow up your plant or something. They said, we're not going to do business with you anymore. And I guess I had a hard time seeing how awful that was. Now, I'm sure Zapata liked having the business, but maybe they didn't like having the business. It's such a deadbeat business partner. We're never going to pay you. We're never going to, you know, okay, so fine. So they say we're never going to pay you. That means you bring your lawsuit and say we're entitled to the price.
It's the fact that Linnell said, we know that you have shipped us over the past 3 years 1.6 million tins that we haven't paid for, and we know that we've accepted them and used them.
Yeah.
We're simply not going to pay you for them unless you continue to ship us goods without requiring us to pay for the past ones.
But why is that so wild? It seems to me that just means you bring an action. Now you know that there's a definitive breach of the contract under all contract laws of the world, whether it was Mexican law that was applying or whether it was the CISG or whether it was any law, Illinois law, you can bring an action for the price. And you do that.
Well, it's not, first of all, the bad faith was in ultimately utilizing the judicial system by denying that there was any liability to Zapata before
the. But that was their general denial. Then 3 months later, they admit the $600,000.
They continue the general denial all the way through the end of the trial when they move for judgment as a matter of law as to the entire claim that Zapata was bringing.
Well,
and use those defenses. And I think it's important also to respond to counsel's indication that Judge Shader found that the defenses and counterclaims were all valid. In fact, Judge Shader held precisely to the contrary. Judge Shader specifically found that those defenses and counterclaims were used as an essential component of the bad faith that Linnell engaged in during the litigation to make the litigation as expensive, as convoluted, as difficult as possible for Zapata to be able to recover even the first dime.
It was Judge Shader with this ruling about partial summary judgment that protracted the trial.
At the time that we brought that motion for partial summary judgment, Linnell still had more than $300,000 in these defenses and counterclaims, which they were still pursuing and which never could have been the subject of a summary judgment motion. It was not until after the evidence was heard at trial that the judge granted judgment as a matter of law as to that $857,000 in the defenses and counterclaims that Linnell was bringing. So
but
even
look,
if... I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Linnell's own statement of account, which Mr. Cole has argued in his brief, shows an outstanding balance, this is Judge Shader's opinion, of over $600,000. So at least that much would have been off the table. What you just said wouldn't have been possible to say, namely that every last penny was at issue until the end of the trial. $600,000 would have been out.
That's what we argued, but at trial,
no, and Judge Shader should have said, liability is shown unequivocally on $600,000, partial summary judgment.
We made a motion for partial summary judgment. The court held that as to you could not split out a claim and enter partial summary judgment.
That's wrong about that. You must know. I mean, you do plenty of civil procedure. 54B is completely different from 56.
Although if, and I should point out, that as to that $600,000, the case that proceeded thereafter was not consumed with that element of the case. What caused the case to be so protracted was the fact that Linnell was asserting more than 100 individual defenses to these invoices that Zapata had to go through one at a time, claiming that they didn't receive product, that there were fines that it had to pay from customers, which we then had to go and conduct discovery through third parties to prove one at a time that these defenses were frivolous. That there were fines they claimed they paid when in fact they hadn't paid them. There were shipments they claimed they didn't receive when we went to third parties and found out that they did receive them.
Was anything in a written filing that Zapata was doing? Were these in its answers? Were these in papers filed with the court?
This all came out during the course of the trial,
right,
and ultimately was the basis for our motion for judgment as a matter of law.
Like, was it in the pretrial order their position was this? Or
yes.
So why didn't you move under Rule 11 for sanctions?
At the time that up until the evidence itself was presented, there was no vehicle by which we could convey all of the evidence, some of which was going to have to be presented through testimony at trial. It was only after the evidence was considered that it was apparent to the court as a matter of law that these defenses and counterclaims were frivolous.
But if you had done your discovery, surely you weren't doing discovery in the middle of the trial.
No, that's your
If you had done your discovery, you would have been in a position to represent to the court that you thought these failed the Rule 11 test, that they were not positions taken in good faith, and that they were not reasonably supported by the facts, because you would have had your mass of counterfacts, if you will, showing. I mean, I just don't see why Rule 11 was not a vehicle right out there available for you.
The Rule 11, first of all, the Rule 11 motion would not have covered the entirety of the bad faith that Linnell was engaged in, which really pervaded every aspect of the case from its continued.
Well, let's be concrete. Give us an example of one of the 100 defenses that was frivolous.
All right. There was a shipment of $44,000, which Linnell had denied throughout the case that it had ever received that
and
shipment.
And how did you show that that was frivolous?
We contacted a warehouse where these tins were located, and we confirmed that, in fact, those had been received by Linnell, but that Linnell had moved those tins.
And you did that during the discovery?
We did that during discovery.
And so why didn't you why did that have to go to trial? You see, there's a paradox. We don't usually think that we have trials on frivolous issues. We get people arguing about frivolousness when, you know, the case is dismissed under 12b-6 or you know, Rule 56. So,
Linnell presented.
Okay, so you had this, obviously you had irrefutable evidence about this warehouse.
Linnell denied that was irrefutable evidence. It testified in the deposition that it didn't receive them.
Pardon?
It testified. Linnell's witnesses testified.
So you had a live witness who was contradicting the documents.
And ultimately at trial, their CFO finally admitted that they did receive them, but then they asserted a brand new defense relating to that shipment, which the court had already ordered in limine that Linnell was not going to be permitted at trial to assert new defenses that it had never asserted before. What the CFO said at trial was, well, we did receive them, but they were junk. We couldn't use them. Linnell had already stipulated prior to trial that every tin that it received had in fact been used and had been accepted. And ultimately, after all of that was presented to the court, then the court granted judgment as a matter of law on that claim at the end of the case. I think also with respect to the question of Rule 11, I'd like to point out that in Chambers, the Supreme Court did indicate that the fact that conduct would be sanctionable under another rule or statute would not preclude a court from issuing a sanction under the court's inherent power if the court concluded that Rule 11 or other sanctions were not up to the
standard. Because after all, Rule 11 was deliberately modified, softened. Remember? First it was very strict, and then it was apparently Judge Sater thought it had been defanged. Well, if the rules process results in the weakening of a rule, you can't have the judge saying, well, I'm going to now use my inherent authority to restore the original rule.
Ultimately, what the judge, I don't believe that what the court was doing was trying to make up for inadequacies in Rule 11. I think that what the court did, and what the court ultimately found, was that bad faith sanctions under the court's inherent power were warranted because the bad faith pervaded the entire litigation. And in Chambers itself, the court affirmed the imposition of case-wide attorney's fees under the court's inherent power. Based on the finding, and the court applied a test in which the court articulated that if the bad faith is repetitive and pervades the litigation, it is within the court's discretion to impose those case-wide fees. And I think in this particular case, I think it's important also to recognize that Linnell never objected on this ground. The court not only issued its initial finding that bad faith sanctions were warranted, the court then conducted 8 months of proceedings in which the court took evidence as to the nature of the bad faith conduct, in which the court explored why it was that these defenses and counterclaims multiplied the cost of the litigation.
Was anyone talking about Rule 11 or 1927 during this 8-month period?
Linnell never.
Oh, were you?
No,
for
we
example,
did not.
You didn't in any way ground your motion for fees under those rules.
No. What we were seeking to do during that process was to show how every aspect of Linnell's defense to this case, both in terms of its defense to our case and also the pursuit of its counterclaims, were all part of a bad faith effort to make the case as expensive as possible and to make the case seem needlessly complicated to the jury in order to justify an argument, which they made, which was that it was so complicated. The case was so complicated that there was no way to figure out what was really owed. In other words, that was what we presented the evidence to show, and the court's findings, which we've quoted in our brief, were the result of this extended process. I think that the findings that the court made make clear that there was no way that the bad faith was not limited to one sanctionable pleading. Nor did Linnell ever prove that had one sanctionable pleading when it was withdrawn, that all of a sudden this litigation would have ended. And I think it's also important to note that the court ultimately granted judgment as a matter of law as to $857,000. And as Judge Sater found, Linnell was using this litigation, using the judicial system, as an excuse not to pay.
But you're, of course, not saying that any time a Rule 50 judgment is granted at the close of all the evidence, that an inherent power fee shift occurs.
Absolutely not. We're not suggesting that at
I
all.
I don't read too much into the fact that at the end of all the evidence, Rule 50 judgments do happen.
What the judge found was that Linnell's defense of that $857,000 had no basis, and that there was no grounds as a matter of law on which they could contest that.
But you told me a minute ago that very little of the trial was devoted to the $600,000 or to the $800,000, that it was actually focused on other matters. Is that not true?
Most of the discovery and most of the trial was certainly consumed with us having to refute the defenses and counterclaims that Linnell was asserting. But they nonetheless forced us to have to go through and prove up our case because they continued to deny that they owed anything. They continued to argue that there was no way to figure out what was owed. And it's also notable that not only did the court grant judgment as a matter of law at the $857,000, Linnell hasn't even appealed that aspect, any aspect.
But if they had appealed, you'd say that was more bad faith, right?
Well, I think ultimately it confirms that there was no basis for their opposition to that aspect. And I think it's also notable, I see that my time is up.
Go ahead.
Respectfully request that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Cole, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute if you have anything of urgency.
It is absolutely false that 8 months was spent demonstrating to Judge Shader through discovery and all the other processes how bankrupt the defenses were and the counterclaims. But that's just not true. Judge Shader's opinion, if you look in the record, dealing with the inherent authority, is a half a page. Zapata's submission was 2 pages, and that's what he relied on. The remaining time was spent in proving that they were entitled to $550,000 worth of fees. That's all. Nothing else was ever done to dissect this record, to parse this record, and show how frivolous in its entirety everything was. The counterclaims, it is absolutely untrue, were frivolous. They may not have been accepted by the jury. We say that is in large part because of the way Judge Shader conducted the proceedings, and there was not a chance at all to have any kind of a fair trial. Whether they're guilty or not guilty, liable or not, is really not the issue. What happened, quite simply, is Judge Shader said that $100,000 of the $200,000 counterclaim, which was devoted to the olive can chargeback, was, as he called it, a big ticket item that absolutely was entitled to jury consideration. I don't have the time to talk about the facts that are in our brief. If ever there was a legitimate claim, it was the olive can claim. There were other aspects of the defense and counterclaim that were absolutely legitimate. The $300,000 question of whether interest was owed or not could not have been more legitimate. That went to the jury, even though Judge Shader himself didn't think much of it. He let it go to the jury. He never suggested that that was fraudulent or frivolous. The question was there a course of dealing that obviated from our perspective, obviated the question of interest. That's a legitimate question under the code. And finally, as to the interstice that needed to be filled, Rule 11 would have dealt adequately with the denial in the answer which Judge Wood adverted to, which was the second and the only basis on which Judge Shader concluded that the inherent authority award was proper. That denial was cured within 3 months by the responses. It cost $14,580 to cure that denial by causing Linnell to be forced to comply with the discovery request.
Thank you. Mr. Cole, Mr. Rubenstein. Move on to the next case, Drager v.